was a long process of coming to this platform. And it is radical in the best sense of the word, of striking at the root of the problem. And I think of the quote from Henry David Thoreau, "For every 1,000 striking at the branches of evil, there is one striking at the root." And a libertarian is someone who believes in freedom. Freedom is what you have when no one is forcing their will on you in any way, when your rights are respected, when your ability to exercise them is limited only by the rights of others. That's freedom. Any violation of freedom is a violation of ethics. The fact that you own yourself, don't hit, don't steal, don't kill. These are universal human ethical principles, and we pay all the costs of them when they're done by state agents, just as much as by people acting on their own behalf. Well, what would you do about this? What would you do about that? What about this agency? What about that agency? And the answers were all really easy, and they were all really beautiful, about the implications for every American, about how much better our lives get right away with this one radical initial step towards decentralization of government, localization. So,
I'm proud to share with you Tetragen, which helps you transition to a healthier, happier, and thinner you without cravings or side effects. Our metabolic hormones are the underlying problem that doom every diet and exercise program to fail. They control our metabolism, cravings, how much we eat to feel satiated, blood sugar levels, and even our energy levels. Tetragen is formulated with 4 clinically proven patented ingredients that help rebalance your metabolic hormones in roughly 15 to 20 days, depending on the amount of weight you want to lose. Once your metabolic hormones are rebalanced, you'll be on the path of long-term, sustainable weight loss because Tetragen is the first in the world which is scientifically formulated with 4 clinically proven and patented active ingredients to help you reach your targeted weight in 2 distinct phases. Phase 1, rebalance your metabolic hormones, and phase 2, accelerate fat loss. The best part is that Tetragen comes with a 60-day money-back guarantee. So what do you have to lose besides weight? Learn more with the link below.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. I am joined with Adam Kokesh. He is the front runner at the moment in the Libertarian Party. He's raised almost 10 times as much as any of the other candidates, and he has this pretty radical platform of just abolishing the federal government. But as you dig into it and you talk to him, there's some good things, just getting back to fundamentals. And so we talk about it, and I drill him on different issues, all the big issues, and how it would work. And then we get into, as he said, we geek out. We did kind of geek out because we got into into intellectual property rights and patents and so forth, and kind of went too into the weeds, but it was good. I mean, I could do that on a lot of different subjects, and he was willing to do it even more. And it got long, and so this is a couple parts, this show. It might be 2 or 3, but it was excellent. And I think that he resonates with a lot of people because people are so fed up with our federal government. And what are we going to do with this big behemoth of a problem that we have in this country? I sure the heck don't want to do what the far left people want to do with re-educating people and putting them in gulags. I mean, that's the last thing that we should do. That's the most violent, vile thing you can do to human beings. You know, take away their will and their rights and subject them to what you think is best. So we get into all of that, and it's just great. And then he stays after for my patrons, and then he talks more about how do you deal with the institutionalized thinking and get past all that. And then we get into some funny things, though. He calls it the soup concept and some locker room talk that probably isn't appropriate in general. So it's at least as a Patreon only. So if you want to get to that, it's Sarah Westall. Oh, I'm sorry. It's patreon.com/Sarah Westall. And then again, patrons have access coupon discount codes, especially for the C60. Everybody knows what's going on with this virus. You have 10% off for my patrons with the gel caps, the C60 gel caps. But let's get into this really interesting conversation with Adam Kokesh. Adam, thank you so much for joining the program.
Hey, my pleasure, Sarah.
I've heard so many things about you, good things, you know, because I got to meet your campaign manager when I was down in China. And I'm like, I got to interview this guy because you're the leading candidate in the Libertarian Party at the moment. You were a host on RT. You have this huge following. And I say leading candidate because you've, what, raised 10 times more than anyone else in the party. Is that correct at this point?
Right. I think that's come down a little bit based on all the candidates who have jumped in and made some fundraising efforts. But yeah, we are in a different category there.
Well, that's great. Okay. But you have a pretty radical idea, although the more I'm hearing that people are kind of embracing it, and that's why you're moving ahead. Can you talk about dissolving the whole government, which is when you first hear, you think you're just crazy. And that's what Elijah was thinking. He went down there to talk to you, and then he ended up being your campaign manager, which is kind of a funny story. But can you explain what you mean? Do you really mean dissolve the entire federal government, or are we still going to have a government? I mean, what does that really mean?
Well, Sarah, thank you for getting straight to the heart of the matter there. And I really do appreciate you presenting it this way, because you know, I'm a longtime libertarian activist. I've got all the credentials that I would want to have as a civil disobedience activist. And I've been involved with the Libertarian Party for, I guess, let's see, since, I want to say, is it decades? How old? I'm 38. Like, does it add up to decades? But yeah, I became a lifetime member in 2004 when I got back from Iraq, from when I could first afford it. And it was a long process of coming to this platform. And it is radical in the best sense of the word, of striking at the root of the problem. And I think of the quote from Henry David Thoreau, "For every 1,000 striking at the branches of evil, there is one striking at the root." And while there are a lot of people who have an initial reaction, and as libertarians, we tend to be self-conscious, and this has led a lot of us to support candidates who don't really represent the really beautiful, ethical, philosophical message at the heart of libertarianism, which is not a political message. A libertarian is someone who believes in freedom. Freedom is what you have when no one is forcing their will on you in any way. When your rights are respected, when your ability to exercise them is limited only by the rights of others. That's freedom. Any violation of freedom is a violation of ethics. The fact that you own yourself, don't hit, don't steal, don't kill. These are universal human ethical principles, and we pay all the costs of them when they're done by state agents, just as much as by people acting on their own behalf. Don't hit, don't steal, don't kill is not, unless you're a cop or an IRS agent or a soldier. Government as we know it today is a coercive, unethical enterprise. And what we're doing as libertarians is not creating some new political flavor or brand of statism of how to use this government thing to force some vision on the world, but rather to say, no, let's make it ethical. Let's raise the standard of ethics and say, no, if you're going to have government, and this is in the Libertarian Party Statement of Principles, where governments exist, they must be voluntary. So there are a lot of ways I come to this platform of localization. And part of it is that we see polarization having taken over the United States today, and a lot of modern political, politically advanced countries with systems similar to the United States, where if you're a liberal and you're a conservative and you meet on the street, you kind of have to see each other as enemies.
Like, yeah, it's gotten crazy.
We're going to fight over policy. Yeah, and it reinforces and reentrenches, and social media makes it worse. And it's based on this premise that you're going to fight over an issue. One of you is going to win, the other is going to lose, and you're going to have the winner's will forced on the loser through government. And you think, well, I'm the winner, you're the loser. No, you're both losing now to the people who control the process, who control the system. And with localization, you can say, look, okay, you're a liberal, you live in a liberal state, you're a conservative, you live in a conservative state. That's great. I hope you're happy there. I don't want to live that way, but I want you to be able to live that way. And that's, I can't imagine, like, anything else would be un-American. to say, no, you can't live that way. You have to be forced. You cannot declare your independence. You have to be forced into a centralized system. That's insane. So the process for me, going back to this, goes all the way back to 2012. I was at Bilderberg in Northern Virginia, not as an attendee. No, I was just there as an observer.
Oh, sure.
And it was my first chance. Yeah, this is really a secretly planned from the elites to give
I'm
up
kidding.
All of their power yeah. unwillingly. I don't know. So I got to meet Alex Jones for the first time in person there, and my friend Jason Burmis, the original Info Warrior. And we're debating freedom versus statism. And at some point he goes, oh, yeah, well, what would you do if you were president? And I went, and then I got over that. Remember, this is 2012. I'm 7 years younger than eight years younger than today in 2012 in Virginia. And he said, no, really, what would you do? I said, well, I quit. I go home. I get a real job. This is not a position that should exist. How can I, in good conscience, knowing that this authority is illegitimate, how dare I exercise that authority over anyone? So to say, okay, well, I get rid of the federal government, you know, let the states be sovereign. You give me unjust authority, I will destroy it. Give me the ring, I will throw it in the fire. Simple as that. And I first started from that ethical premise of, no, I cannot exercise an illegitimate authority. And then people kept asking me questions over the years. Well, what would you do about this? What would you do about that? What about this agency? What about that agency? And the answers were all really easy. And they were all really beautiful about the implications for every American, about how much better our lives get right away with this one radical initial step towards decentralization of government, localization. So every time I have to introduce myself as a presidential candidate, I throw up in my mouth a little bit, but you get it now. I'm not running to be president. I'm running to turn the election to a referendum, and I'd be resigning on day one.
Okay, so what would the government look like? All the states would have, everything would go down to the states. No federal government. Would we work together, or would there
right.
just be 52 states and some territories or whatever? Would there just be a bunch of states that are countries now? You know, each state is now its own country.
Right. That's the idea, that every state would be sovereign. And specifically in this peaceful, orderly, responsible bankruptcy process, every sovereign Native American tribe also has the right to petition to be recognized as an independent nation, to have lands stolen and treaty violations returned to them, and to have the full rights that any state would have. When you say, would we work together? Yeah, and a lot more and a lot better than we do today. When you say the American people, would we work together? Well, the federal government is not a facilitator of trade in any way or interstate commerce, let's say. If anything, it's an impediment with taxes, regulations, all the things it does to slow down trade and commerce. What we'd have in terms of working together would be much better, much more effective. When government is localized down to the community level, and that's really the ultimate goal here, it transforms into something that's voluntary as opposed to coercive and unethical, because a community is something that you choose to be a part of. And when government is down at that geographic community level, only things that community wants handled within that geography by a single entity are going to be done that way. And governments become more like competing service providers. So if you have a community where you want socialism, you know, hey, you can have that. You just can't force it on anybody else. And you want ethnostatism like that, you know, fine, I'm not going to live there. That's abhorrent, but I'm not going to interfere with your right to do that. You know, I actually like that. I get that, you've got me like, you know, tipped off and passionate about this, but I'll let you please.
No, but that's great. I have some questions about what do you do with a massive federal agency like the military? I mean, we have this huge yeah. military with a significant part of our budget. What do you do with that? Because that's something very significant. I mean, if everything goes on the States, where does that go?
Yeah, well, let me just put it in perspective first with some bigger numbers. Because most people I ask, even people who are pretty educated about government and politics, have really no idea about these numbers. Do you know how many people work for government in the United States at the state, federal, and local level, direct government employees?
Well, I know there's some states that are going over 50% now. I don't know what that translates to, and obviously you can't.
I think you're thinking welfare plus government employees. They're at over 50%.
Okay. Well, I don't know what the actual numbers are. So yeah, share.
So you would think like this would be more common knowledge, but this is one of those things that government likes to hide from us, to obscure. But it's 22 million people who work for government at all levels in the United States, 22 million. The federal government, and I ask people after telling them this, and they still have guesses all over the place, the federal government is only 3 million out of that 22 million. So again, just for perspective, I'm embarrassed how moderate this plan is. I'm talking about cutting less than 1 in 7 government jobs in the United States, and a lot of them are going to get reabsorbed by state governments or localized in this process. So that gets us to the military, right? For the military, all the troops brought home from overseas, all the equipment, the bases returned to their home countries are sold, and then the military is basically split into two categories. Either it's something that meets a legitimate defensive purpose, infantry, small arms, tanks, anti-aircraft, things like that. And those get apportioned among the states. Everything that has no legitimate defensive purpose, nukes, DARPA, long-range drones, nuclear submarines, all these things de-weaponized, liquidated, and the proceeds go to fund Social Security until it runs out and we transition to a better system.
Now, do you think that would put us at risk, or do you think as long as you have a really strong defensive military, by liquidating all that another country couldn't take advantage of us?
Well, I'm so glad you asked, Sarah, because the question does come up, and what's so important is to really examine the premise of this question, which is that having a military makes you safer. And the fact is, that's not true. The opposite is true. Surprise, surprise, government is lying to you about that. And the founders of this country were explicitly against anything that they thought of as a standing army. The U.S. military today would certainly qualify as a standing army by their definition. And I can tell you a little bit about how having a military makes us less safe from my experience in Iraq, where we literally made enemies faster than we could kill them. And I mean the word literally there, literally, not figuratively. We literally created enemies faster than we could kill them. The global war on terror was designed that way. So you look at the reality of the world, it's American military imperialism that makes us less safe, that creates so much conflict and death and destruction in the world that has no justification whatsoever. It is truly a sick and disgusting blight on humanity at this point. But even more fundamentally than that, we have to examine the premise by asking the question, what is war? And this is another big thing we are lied to. Imagine that from the very beginning in government schools, we are taught wars are fought between countries. It was America versus Japan versus Germany versus China versus Russia. No, nonsense. Wars are not fought between countries. They are conducted by governments using violence to expand their protection rackets. And the ultimate proof of concept here is Afghanistan, the graveyard of empires. Now, I'm not endorsing their system of tribal government and the great oppressions against women that occur there or any other individual civil liberties violations that are a part of that system. But the basic proof of concept of a well-armed population that refuses to be governed by anyone being the ultimate defense, there's no greater proof than that. And I would also cite Admiral Yamamoto from World War II, who said the reason the Japanese didn't go directly to invading the mainland of America is that there would be, quote, a rifle behind every blade of grass. We need to be much safer and more secure than we are now. We are vulnerable not only because the U.S. federal government is making enemies in our name all over the world, but it is sending a message to the world that we're not Americans anymore. We're happy being slaves to the system. We're happy to be exploited, to have socialized everything, including defense, as we, I shouldn't say everything, but we have socialized medicine, we have socialized education, we have socialized safety, socialized border control, socialized retirement. And yes, we have socialized defense also, with all of the same negative consequences that you have with socializing everything, except now we're talking about lives hanging in the balance. Militarism is a cancer on the warrior class in America. It is a cancer on freedom and what it's supposed to mean to be American. We have to get rid of the system, and this is just the first step in that, and really a relatively moderate, unifying one, where states are allowed to maintain their national guards as sovereign militaries, and we have an orderly transition rather than a sudden one to this more ethical system that the founders would have advocated for.
Okay, well, let's talk about China, because, okay, you saw the Project Veritas videos of people saying that they want to put re-educate people like you who are too free and thinking and don't want to be controlled.
Yeah.
People like me, they're serious about this. I've met people who are very serious about that. China, that's their model. They're a socialist communist, Chinese communist, right? They're large, 1.6 billion people. They have a lot of control. Now, if they become the powerhouse and we break up into multiple states, what risk do we have of them coming in and exerting their will on us?
Well, again, I got to look at the premises of your question here. I mean, the less government we have, the more powerful we are, the safer, the freer, the more prosperous. All of these things get better with less government, or at least less coercion of government, taking us back from our potential. This gets back to the heart of capitalism, voluntary exchange, free trade, individuals exchanging goods and services because they see it benefits them. You have a win-win relationship when it's voluntary. You have a win-lose when you have government coercion involved. So we get, first of all, we get more powerful by breaking up the government in the United States, becoming united in freedom instead of united in government. And to think that China with more of a government is going to be more powerful is to say that communism works. And I think I in history would disagree vehemently with that. But I would also point to what we're experiencing today, where governments, as violent monopolies, they follow economic centers of power. They exist to serve the current superclass or elites, if you will. And this is not to be conspiratorial at all. Just, you know, the several thousand most powerful people in the world who pull the strings of society, because they're empowered to through central banks, through modern corporatism, through modern governments. And they're going to do that anyway. So what we see already in the United States is a shift to this, with Chinese companies being able to buy up companies and properties in the United States. If you're from China and you as an individual want to come here and homestead and make your way, let this be the land of the free. Absolutely. But if you're a Chinese business owner or government bureaucrat who's waving around, you know, tens of millions of U.S. dollars because the U.S. government through the Federal Reserve System screwed things up with the economic balance between and the trade deficit with China, so that you have these little bubbles, these massive imbalances where, you know, major chunks of the American economy are being bought out by foreigners unjustly. I don't want to see that anymore.
Well, yeah. Well, okay. So now let's talk about another big issue, and that would be the central bankers. What would we do with the Federal Reserve, the dollar, this upcoming digital currency?
Yeah.
I mean, how would we be able to deal with all that? And as you know, the central bankers, anytime any country's not in their system, they tend to take them over and make them be part of their system. So how do we deal with that?
Well, there are two questions kind of packed into that one. And I want to come back to the second one, which is how do we overcome institutional resistance, if you will, right? You know, like from other banking systems or from, you know, the people who are the current profiteers of the system, or won't the Supreme Court stop you? I'll come back to that, because you asked the perhaps, you know, more pressing question that I don't get often enough, honestly, even within the Libertarian Party. I got to hand it to Ron Paul for getting people thinking and talking about monetary systems and getting people to understand what the destructiveness of the Federal Reserve really was, because it was huge. It is huge. Excuse me. I'm trying to talk about it like it's already dead and gone. That's my own little wishful thinking, perhaps Freudian slip there. But no, the Federal Reserve is hugely destructive in creating massive misallocations of resources. And the most disgusting one is war. I think it's a Ron Paul quote where he said it's no coincidence that the century of total war coincided with the century of central banking, referring, of course, to the 20th century. Now, in the 21st, I'd like to think we're on the verge of evolving past this. And the ultimate goal is to get to free market money. So to say what is the alternative here, to explain what is the Federal Reserve System, obviously I'm not going to try to get into all of that. I would highly recommend Dr. Paul's book and the Fed, but basically it is a monetary system that is forced on people through legal tender laws, where we see if you try to create an alternative monetary system, you end up going to jail, as was the case with Von Nothaus, I think was his name, and the Liberty Dollar, but also with the forced collection of taxes and government doing business in that fiat currency. And fiat just means by declaration. So it has value not by being backed by anything or, you know, being exchangeable for anything, but by fiat, by government declaration. The U.S. dollar has value, and really by violence. It's backed up by violence. It's if you don't find dollars to pay your taxes, then we're going to take your stuff away. And if you resist, we're going to take you away. You know, and this is the big scam at the bottom of things, property tax, right? And I own 10 acres in the mountains of northern Arizona, the Garden of Freedom, and I love it there, but I don't own it, you know, in the way that I really would like to. And I still consider myself the owner, but in order to maintain my privilege of ownership, I have to pay a rent government property tax, and it's very low where I'm at. I chose carefully. But, you know, once a year, I have to give them a couple $100, and it's like, wow, this is not right. But the effect is far-reaching when you have as successfully imposed a fiat currency system as most governments in the world have today, and no one holds a candle to the U.S. Federal Reserve System and the Federal Reserve Bank for being the world reserve currency, for being the petrodollar, for being imposed on so many economic systems that they are allowed to steal from by creating more money. If I can force you to use my money, and I'm the only one who can create more of it, and I can just create it out of thin air, well, then I can devalue all the dollars in circulation, all the money in your bank account, in your back pocket, lose value when I create more dollars, whether it's through fractional reserve banking or through federal borrowing or any of their other tricks and schemes by which they impose this fiat currency system on us. And the result with war, could they pay for this ridiculously outsized military industrial complex? Could they pay for these wars in the tens of trillions of dollars now with Afghanistan and Iraq? It would not. All of the greatest evils of government are made possible by them being able to snap their fingers, borrow trillions of dollars, and then redirect economic resources where they shouldn't go. And it's not just, oh, this money's being spent on things we don't want it to. And it's not just, oh, people are dying in war, as if that wasn't bad enough. It's also when that money is misallocated, and you look at the corruption of the healthcare industry in the United States, it's one more surgery that we can't afford. It's one more kid dying of some disease needlessly because we couldn't put the money into R&D because we were busy sending all of that money and resources to the Federal Reserve System's imbalances with the military-industrial complex. It is so destructive. So the goal is to get to a non-coercive monetary system or free market money. And Bitcoin has already shown that we are more than capable of this. Everything that we can do on the blockchain with cryptocurrencies. The question is, how do we make that transition? How do we unplug the Fed? And I believe I have one modest proposal here that neatly wraps up the bankruptcy process of, well, first of all, we disown the debt. The debt that the federal government owns on paper or owes is illegitimate. You can't force it on someone who didn't have a say in it. And it's intergenerational child abuse to say you are born into this country and you have a price tag on your butt for in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. That's insane. It's abusive. So we just disown that. We write it off in the bankruptcy. My responsibility as the bankruptcy agent of the federal government, my fiduciary responsibility, is to pay back the true creditors, namely the American people. So as we liquidate the assets of the federal government, including all of the land, the 50% of land in Western states that the federal government claims it owns, that we give it back directly to the American people by issuing every American 1,000 digital security tokens called AmeriCoin by social security number. So everybody will get an equal share to their claim of what's been stolen from us and what we are giving back as directly as possible to the American people. All those assets get auctioned off. As we collect the revenue, it goes to fund Social Security until that money runs out. And as the auction ends of all the federal assets, the American people have the option to keep using AmeriCoin like a cryptocurrency or to make the transition. But what's going to happen here is that we remove the federal backing from the U.S. dollar. States can continue using it. There can be a peaceful transition. But overall, what we're doing, giving that economic power, that wealth, that inheritance back to every American directly, is a kind of re-leveling of the debt record, taking back what's been stolen. All of the misallocations of wealth that are measured in dollars are going to get leveled out in a huge way as we give the American people back what's been stolen from us.
Okay, so basically, the states, there'd be so much more money in the hands of the people. So they get to, at each state level, they'll have the ability to make a decision whether they want to, how they want to take care of the disabled, how they want to do their health care and their education and all these things, right? So that takes care of all those kinds of issues. There's two other big issues that I want to talk about. People that are in federal prison. How do you deal with these, you know, there's a lot more people that need to be in prison, I'm telling you. So those are two questions I have.
No, it's a lot less. It's a lot less overall. Trust me, Sarah. But no, that's an easy, the federal prisons, that's an easy one.
Yeah. And then what do we do about the corrupt layer that we have right now going after? And, you know, there's this whole group that want to put people into re-education and gulags versus let's just go after the people who are criminals who have never been held accountable for their corruption. What do we do with those, that whole corruption layer that is federal level and state, but go ahead.
Well, I want to start with a little bit more of a spiritual note, if I may, to answer this question before going to the immediate policy of federal prisoners, which is that most of the violence and evil done in the world today is done either in the name of or empowered by governments. And what we're talking about in getting past this paradigm of violence and coercion is not just we're going to stop fighting so much, we're all going to be wealthier and happier and freer as a result, but that there has to be a point of acceptance of not being so materialistic, because we're going to be so much better off overall. To demand perfect justice at some point becomes counterproductive to happiness. There has to be a huge element of forgiveness and acceptance in this. And
but hold on, I want to hold on. The forgiveness and acceptance of people who maybe have been blackmailed or whatever, but the people who have been doing human trafficking, doing some really bad stuff. I'm not going to let you say just forgive them. But go ahead.
I'm so with you there, Sarah. What I'm talking about, and I thought you were being perhaps much more inclusive, is like, no, we're not going to cut off every IRS agent's right hand as we kick him out the door. Like, no, in that sense, for me, you know, I'm a combat veteran, and I was a party to a war crime. Are we going to go chase down every veteran who we know from their military records killed an innocent person by accident in Iraq or Afghanistan? No, we're not. That's not a part of this.
And that's why I compared it to this whole gulag re-education thing versus corruption. We don't want to go to some extreme like that, but we have to get rid of this corruption layer that is killing society no matter what government you have set up.
Right. So here we go on that then. Transitioning back to the policy here. For people who are locked up in federal prison, there is one thing I will do as president, exercising presidential power, and that's the power of the pardon, to pardon everyone who is in federal prison for victimless crimes, for drug trafficking, because that's no victim, no crime.
And that's before you dissolve the government? Really so you got to do a certain things for like a month or something and then dissolve it? But go ahead.
No. This is like I sign one document.
Oh, it's all part of that. Okay.
That's I resign. Yeah. Now, and we can get into the timing mechanics of this as well, too, because we've got most of that figured out well detailed. Then we have a process, and there will be a, you know, like right today, as we have an attorney general, we would call them the custodial attorney general. There will be a custodial head of the Bureau of Prisons to oversee this process. Basically, everybody who has either done their time for whom there's no purpose of them doing time any further will be released, transitioned out if they're not a threat to society. If they should be locked up, very simple. They get transitioned to state prisons or state authority, and their sentences are transitioned to those state governments. We're not challenging anything there. But to your bigger question of the people who get away with heinous crimes today within the federal government's protection shadow, if you will. And, you know, before we started, we were talking about Hillary Clinton and all the crazy things that she has been a part of over the years. And it is, you know, we know that Jeffrey Epstein didn't kill himself. I love that that's become a touchstone on the internet.
Tell my local media that. Tell my local media that Epstein didn't kill himself, because they just say it straight face like it's fact and then move on to another. Like, come on. But that media is another subject. Go ahead.
I love that we have the Epstein story now exactly the way that we have it, because everybody has something that, you know, no matter your ideology, you can look at that and be like, someone's full of crap. It's just that they screwed up with the Epstein case because it was so high profile when he got arrested. It was international news. It was salacious. It was juicy. It had sex and crime and lots of money and elite. It was just like it was made for TV news. And then they went to cover it up with the Jeffrey Epstein suicide and whatever, you know, he could have been murdered. He could have got his body swapped out. He could have escaped. There's, you know, half a dozen different things that could have happened. But you look at and then he killed himself. No, they screwed up. So like, just even if he did kill himself, that they let the report get out that no, he had broken bones, like he was choked. You know, or that whatever body it was, I don't even, there's so many different rabbit holes, but just the one thing we can agree on looking at this is Jeffrey Epstein didn't kill himself.
Exactly.
Something's really fishy here. And that is, to me, that's like a beautiful hole in the dam. And to that, I say, yes, the people who are a real threat, who are engaging in human trafficking, they need to be held accountable. The more centralized government is, the more corrupt it becomes, the easier it is for criminals to corrupt. That's the people who are doing the corrupting. It's criminals, by definition, who are doing the corrupting of government, that they're going to be involved in other crimes or crimes of other more direct, hideous natures is entirely predictable as an unintended consequence, but really a built-in feature of this system that they want to preserve, that they are able to corrupt FBI agents, that they are able to corrupt local criminal investigations. And so we get government to the state level right away. You're going to have the freedom for a lot of people to demand real justice services from their governments. I think that's a step in the right direction. there are a lot of ways that I could go in terms of the ultimate goal of a more free, more just society. There's way more that we can do in this realm. We are so failing our potential as a species to hold real criminals accountable, largely because we have entrusted criminals with this process. We have empowered them to arrest people for victimless crimes. We don't have a clear global standard of what is justice. And we do, but we allow governments to pervert it because it's the natural law. It's really simple. Self-ownership. You own yourself. That's why it's wrong to violate that self-ownership anyway, to wrong you, to violate your freedom, your rights by force, fraud, or coercion. Those are ethical violations. Everybody knows this. Every human being inherently knows.
Well, for example, I just read an article this morning that a veteran just got life in prison for having an ounce of marijuana. And then you have others that are walking around.
Yeah, but you fought for...
Yeah, it's just BS. It's just... So we have that, the extreme case of BS. Yeah. And then we have the extreme case of BS on the other side of all these people that were involved with Epstein who... You know what I'm talking about. Anybody who's been paying attention, I cover a lot of human trafficking issues. Anybody who's been paying attention knows there's this. So you got this extreme example of somebody who should never have been getting life in prison for such a ridiculous crime to people who are walking free for doing the worst. And that just starting to deal with that in a meaningful way would change just the hopes of so many people.
Yeah. And this is a really simple realignment of punishment versus justice.